Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is the day after Labor Day, so this is the day that, by tradition, the presidential campaign actually really begins, that people make the final stretch. Of course, that's not true anymore since we've been in the campaign since, I don't know what, like 3 years now? It feels like forever. But at least there's that marker. My newsletter this morning, actually, and I don't get mad at me here, but I mentioned before that I always try to think, what are we missing? What do we not know is going to happen? So I did an interview with my future self, November 11th, after the election. I picked it because it's actually my birthday. And I understand that the election might not be resolved by November 11th. But I try to imagine an interview with myself saying, how did you get this wrong again? And going through what possibly might happen to give Donald Trump reelected. Now, I don't actually believe this because I think the state of the race is very clear. The polls are quite clear. You have a very amazingly steady lead by Joe Biden. I think Harry Enten from CNN said that going back to 1940, there's never been a lead this steady, closer in the swing states, but still this race has not been jumping around. So if you check out the newsletter today, I would appreciate it. Special guest today, this book is just out, Hoax: Donald Trump, Fox News, and the Dangerous Distortion of Truth, by Brian Stelter, the anchor of CNN's Reliable Sources. Brian, welcome back on the podcast.
Thank you very, very much. Honored to be here. Nothing about this will be a hoax.
Well, I want to get into the book, which focuses very, very heavily, obviously, on Sean Hannity and his relationship with Donald Trump. And you managed to talk. It says on that you talked to 250 Fox News employees to write this book.
Yeah, I describe it as 250 plus people in and around Fox. Okay. So, you know, about 140 current staffers and then lots of former staffers and agents and managers and like the people that know how the place works.
Why do they talk to you? I mean, I know, pick up the phone. Hey, I'm Brian Stelter from your competitor, CNN. Would you like to tell me what's going on over there?
That's actually why I think I was so successful. Yeah. I think it's because I'm in television and understand the TV business. So I'm able to connect with people about ratings and about the pressures of the business and about that kind of conversation that, frankly, you know, I think there's a lot of great reporters out there covering Fox, covering the TV world. But I think I feel it in a way that's different because I'm at CNN. So I think that helped me actually gain sources.
So let's talk about what's been happening over the last several days. Really amazing story. The Atlantic breaks this story. The editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, has the story about Donald Trump calling veterans, including people who had lost their lives, losers and suckers, citing four unnamed sources. But then this story is confirmed by a number of different news outlets, AP, The Washington Post, I believe CNN. And then most remarkably, by Jennifer Griffin, who is a reporter at Fox News. And I want you to talk about this dynamic because it's been really remarkable watching this, that you have a Fox News senior reporter confirming this really damaging story about Donald Trump. And much of the rest of her own network seems to be absolutely committed to discrediting her. So tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, I think about Sean Hannity, for example, not as a newsman, but as a stop the news man, right? He tries to stand athwart the news and stop it. And that's what a lot of the reaction was at Fox on the air when the Atlantic piece broke. So to have Jennifer Griffin corroborating key parts of it, you know, and she would be the first to say she didn't confirm every detail, but she clearly has sources backing up some of the key allegations. Presumably some of the same sources, but maybe the different sources, we don't know. And this was a bombshell for Fox, but also it was kind of too hot to handle. It was too sensitive. It was something that made the network uncomfortable, I think, because so many people on the air were invested in a narrative against the Atlantic, against Jeffrey Goldberg, against the use of anonymous sources. And then comes Jennifer Griffin with this anonymously sourced reporting. It just goes to show how the news side of Fox is losing and the propaganda side is winning. You know, for Trump to be effective, he needs the journalists at Fox to be sidelined, to be suffocated, to be squeezed out. And many of them have been. Many of them have left because they could not take it anymore. Jennifer Griffin has chosen a different path. She's chosen to stay and try to make the place better and try to keep it tethered to the truth as much as she can. And so it was a big victory for her, but also a big headache for her internally. She's got detractors. I mean, it's crazy to say this, but it's true. She has detractors at her company because she went on and did reporting.
Well, that's, I'm trying to imagine what the dynamic must be there to be attacked by your own colleagues on your own air. But there's another right. subtext, of course, which is that the president himself tweets out an attack on her, calling for her to be fired, sort of Trumpian cancel culture. But it is interesting that a number of the Fox News folks have come out in her personal defense. So there's also
right, although mostly off the air. I would, yeah, okay. That is true, but I would say mostly off the air.
Yeah,
there was a notable interview with Neil Cavuto where Cavuto defended her on the air. But even the video headline on FoxNews.com about that segment was tilted, and it was you know, in Trump's favor. All of the coverage surrounding Jennifer Griffin's reporting has been almost all of it in Trump's favor, taking Trump's side, giving Trump the benefit of the doubt. I just don't understand how in 2020, after the president lied to our faces about everything from the weather to voter fraud, why he's still getting the benefit of the doubt. But of course, that's essential at Fox, right? That's how the place wouldn't operate if you didn't assume Trump was telling the truth.
Well, let's go back 4 years. Okay, so four and a half years. Initially, when Donald Trump was running for president, Fox News was not all in for him. In fact, rather famously, Megyn Kelly, who was at Fox at the time, asked him a challenging question. He talked about blood coming out of her, you know, what's or whatever, or wherever's. And then he actually boycotted a presidential primary debate that was hosted by Fox News. So give me some sense of how Fox News became Donald Trump's personal cable network, because it did not initially. That was not the default setting, right? Do you agree with this?
I agree. This was not the default setting. Rupert Murdoch was out there saying, yeah. Why is Donald Trump embarrassing the country?
Yeah.
You know, it's that Trump gradually took over the GOP and gradually took over Fox. Because there was nobody else there to take it over. There was this leadership vacuum at Fox. And so Trump became the North Star. Trump became the audience of one, the way that Roger Ailes used to be. And I think almost everybody at Fox started to see the incentive structure was to be pro-Trump, to be as Trumpy as possible. That was the way to get a better time slot, a fatter contract, to get interviews with the president, to get guest bookings with White House aides. It did not happen all at once. It did happen gradually, but it was this slow but steady takeover. And that, to your point about the 2016 campaign, didn't have to be this way,
right?
Because in 2016, there were skeptics at Fox. There were critics, the Greg Gutfelds of the world, who are now on there bashing the media and doing Trump's bidding, were attacking Trump during the primaries.
They were. And I sometimes play around with the alternative reality. What could have been different, you know, had Rush Limbaugh, you know, broken, you know, against him in late 2015 before he achieved liftoff? If Fox would have remained skeptical, we will never know. So give me your sense of where Fox News is in the right wing media ecosystem. I go back and forth on all this. You know, when people talk about the alternative reality silos that we've created in our media system, people will often point to, well, Fox News, but Fox News is only part of that. They're part of a constellation that's really grown over the last 4 or 5 years. And
right.
It includes what people read on Facebook, what they see on Twitter, what those other communications. So they're not alone doing what they do, but give me your sense of where, if you're mapping out right-wing politics, the significance of Fox News, and how it interacts with the rest of this ecosystem.
Fox is the beating heart, and it supplies blood that then travels all throughout the body. So if the GOP and the right-wing media is this body, Fox is the beating heart. And I think there's a great example of that recently after the Republican convention. Of course, Joe Biden's speech was higher rated on television than Donald Trump's speech. So the GOP needed a counter-narrative. So it launched that counter-narrative on Fox. There was a FoxNews.com story that had a statistic provided by an anonymous, go figure, anonymous campaign official that said that actually the overall viewership on TV and online was higher for the Republicans than was for the Democrats. Now, that's BS. That's a bunch of apples and oranges mashed together into some gross smoothie. It doesn't really work. You can't put TV ratings and online ratings together. They don't fit together. But the GOP tried. Actually, the Biden campaign tried to do the same thing a week earlier. So they're both guilty of this. The difference, of course, is that Biden didn't go out and claim these numbers were real. Trump did. So Fox started the story, and then Trump tweets about it, and then lots of pro-Trump websites copy it and replay it and repeat it. And now there's all these headlines. If you want to believe that Trump actually was higher rated than Biden, which doesn't really matter, but again, Biden did win, so Trump cares, obviously, a lot about this. If you want to believe that Trump was the victor, there are lots of websites that will tell you that now. The Gateway Pundit and Fox, all these sites will tell you Trump won. So there are all these other parts of the body, all these arms and legs and limbs, but I think Fox is the beating heart. Fox is where that narrative started, and Fox is where it all comes back to, right? Whatever Tucker starts with, ends up spreading all across pro-Trump media and, of course, straight to Trump.
So it is this extraordinary feedback loop as well, where the
United States... You know better than I do. Am I getting it right?
You are. Yes, you are getting it right. And it is this amplification of it that it just bounces around. And then you have this feedback loop where the president is sitting watching Fox and Friends, where he's watching Tucker Carlson, and then he tweets out. And it becomes difficult to know, where does the meme begin? Where does the narrative begin? Does it start on Fox? You know, is Fox carrying, is Fox just amplifying Donald Trump's talking points, or is Donald Trump repeating Fox's talking points?
This is the Fox and Friends producer who said to me, people think he's calling up Fox and Friends and telling us what to say. Hell no, it's the opposite. We tell him what to say. This was a former producer, one of these people who snapped and had to leave. But that comment, it does get to this chicken and egg question, this back and forth. There are certainly times when something starts on the fringes or starts on the pro-Trump blogs and then gets all the way up to Fox and thus gets to Trump. So it's like, I'm not sure what the right metaphor is there, you know, but this critical race theory condemnation, this attack against white privilege training at federal agencies, it starts on the right-wing blogs. It starts at Town Hall and Free Beacon and other sites. There's one particular individual, Chris Rufo, pushing this, tweeting about it. He eventually gets booked on Laura Ingraham. Then he gets booked on Tucker Carlson's show. So you can see him moving up the food chain, I suppose. And only once it's on Tucker's show does the president react. So there are those times when something starts from a lower level site or source and then reaches Fox. But there are other times where it starts on Fox. And I write in the book Hoax about the time that Fox basically broadcast a week-long battle over Baltimore, where the president was insulting Elijah Cummings' district, insulting everybody who lived there. And it all started on Fox and Friends Saturday. It all started with a guest who came on ready to go, providing her own video of Baltimore. This is Kimberly Klasick, who's now running in the GOP for the GOP congressional seat there. You know, it all starts on Fox and Friends. But then once Trump tweets about it, and then once Trump posts racist things about Baltimore, then Fox forgets to mention that it started this. So they cover it for a week and they treat it like it's big news because the president's talking about the topic, but they never point out that it started on their own show. And I find that to be something that's broken about this information ecosystem, where Fox doesn't acknowledge its role in it, right? It doesn't acknowledge that it's the beating heart of the body.
Are they worried, or how worried are they about, say, One America News and whether they will outflank them on the right? You know that Trump is playing that card. You know, he thinks that's how he keeps Fox in line by saying, well, we've lost Fox. Fox News is no longer doing what it's doing. You ought to watch One America Network now. Is that what is that dynamic? Are they worried about it? Is it a bluff? Is it where are we
it's
going?
It's a fly on the elephant's back.
Okay.
It's a source of ridicule, of jokes.
Okay.
So when I bring up One America News to folks at Fox, they make fun of it. They say that's crazy, hard right, you know, conspiracy theory crap. They view One America News as a way to differentiate Fox from the hard right or the far right. They'll say, you know, Fox is real news. Fox is versus that crazy stuff over there. The problem, of course, is when there's overlapping. and when some of the crazy gets on to Fox, right? Jesse Waters saying that QAnon's done a lot of great, Q's had a lot of great things.
Yeah,
there is increasingly that overlap. But OAN, Newsmax, look, the ratings are so low to the extent that these channels are rated at all, to the extent that we have any audience data at all. They're so small, even though they're interesting and they are relevant because they are they go viral sometimes for all the wrong reasons. And Trump does use OAN to work the refs with Fox. He knows that Fox is his base. And he knows it because when he attacks an anchor at Fox or a reporter at Fox, like Jennifer Griffin, he then praises Pete Hegseth a few minutes later. So he knows what he has to do. He has to keep the propaganda part intact.
There are tensions, there are divisions within the Fox family. Obviously, you wouldn't have had as many sources if there weren't. There had been a lot of rumors for some time that the Murdoch family might be pivoting away from Trump. Give me some sense, because of course one of the Murdoch sons completely severed was James, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Completely James. Severed his ties. So where are the Murdochs right now on the future of Fox? Are they happy with the way Fox is run right now, the role that it's playing right now?
Well, they are happy with the profits. You know, mm-hmm. the channel on the path to $2 billion a year in profits. That's an extraordinary cable success story. Nobody wants to mess with it. Nobody wants to risk it. And of course, the way you would risk it is by disappointing your pro-Trump viewers, by falling off the...
You just can't do it.
It's so... Look, I felt sympathy for these anchors at Fox who... they feel they don't have any power. They don't feel they have the power to fact check Trump or to challenge pro-Trump guests because the audience turns on them. And this is not hypothetical. It's not like a fear that they think it will happen. No, they know it happens. They saw that Shep Smith was the lowest rated show on the schedule. They knew the reasons why Shep was hated by many Fox viewers. And they wanted to be Shep from a journalistic point of view, but they never wanted to be Shep from a ratings or audience or loyalty point of view.
And incentive
structure.
Yeah, no, I've tried to explain to people that I don't believe that there is a successful business model for an anti-Trump conservative on broadcast media because of exactly what you described. So many people on the right want their talk show, their network to be a safe space for them. They don't want to be hit. So let me talk to me about Shep Smith, because this is a fascinating story, which you describe in your book. Widely respected anchor, guy willing to buck the tide, and then abruptly quit. So what is the story? Why did he quit? And why did he quit that way?
I think the Shep storyline is the best part of Hoax that hasn't really been noticed or talked about or covered. So I'm glad you're bringing it up.
I love this.
There's a lot of material in here about Shep, and he's about to launch a new show on CNBC. So he's going to be back in the news. Look, Shep's fact checks at 3 p.m. were trampled every other hour. He felt like he was there to push back, not just on Trump, but on the BS that was being spread on the network the rest of the day. And that's a wild and unusual job. It's not like there's somebody at MSNBC who's like, I need to debunk what is being said all day long on this channel, right? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen. But it does. It did. Past tense, it did at Fox. Shep thought the rhetoric from his colleagues was shameful in many cases. He thought the CEO of the network, Suzanne Scott, was too weak to take action and pull the network closer to reality. And eventually he snapped. You know, it wasn't one thing, it was 100 things, is what one source said to me. He was frustrated the network wouldn't defend its anchors and reporters when they were attacked by Trump. He was frustrated that the network didn't seem to have standards and practices and checks and balances and all these things that are expected at the NBCs and CNNs of the world. And he was also tired of the harassment from viewers. You know, as a staffer said, he was trying to balance out the entire primetime lineup. And I picture this puny, not puny, I picture this one kid on the playground on one side of the seesaw, and then these three huge kids on the other side of the seesaw. He didn't stand a chance up against Tucker and the rest of the primetime stars.
So how did it work, though? Was he getting pressure from management or not pressure? How does it work? Does anyone have to call you into the office and say, hey, we wish you would be friendlier to Donald Trump, or we wish you wouldn't be more critical?
I think in some ways it's
more subtle.
I think management sometimes wanted him out there challenging Trump because they could point to it and say, we have this on the air. This happens on the air. Fox is not all you think it is, right? Because the key part of the message to advertisers right now is Fox is, you have to be on Fox. It's got all points of view. But for Shep, I think you know, he certainly had detractors internally. He had people who thought he was too liberal. He was trying too hard to balance out the primetime shows. One insider said to me, he just got madder and madder and madder, and he aired it on the channel. Another said he couldn't work at state-run TV anymore. You know, it was this sense of just absolute frustration. He eventually tells his agent, his manager, he has to get out of his deal. That, you know, he had a 3-year deal and he left in the middle of a 3-year deal, which is incredibly unusual. Here's what's frustrating to me. He's never talked about why he left. Well, he's making $15 million a year. He gave at least some of that up in order to leave. And look, he's never talked about why. And I think that's a shame. I know that this is complicated and there's contractual reasons, and in TV, it's always complicated. But these people that leave Fox because they think it's the propaganda's too much. They should tell the public. They should find a way to tell the public. And maybe some of them have by leaking to me through their friends and through their colleagues or something. I don't know. But I've got a lot of stories in this book about people that have left Fox for various reasons. But I do think there's so much that's not being said. The difference between what's on the air and what's off the air, with how Sean Hannity talks about Trump off the air versus on the air. There's hypocrisy there that I hope people can see and understand.
Well, let's talk about that. How do you know what Sean Hannity says off the air?
So this in the book came from friends and associates of him, of his, sometimes colleagues who work with him at Fox. But, you know, he doesn't interact with a lot of people at Fox because he mostly hosts his program from home. So I relied on his friends and his kind of social circle to give a sense of what Hannity is saying. And I'm not claiming that every day Hannity is frustrated by Trump, but there certainly have been times where he's been tired of the run-on sentences and the nonsense and the grievances. And he has talked about Trump as being crazy the way that so many others have. He just would never acknowledge that on the air. You know, I think there's this difference between the on-air and off-the-air views. These folks at Fox know a lot about the president. And in some cases, they're not telling us, right? And that's notable. And it's not as if Rupert Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch wanted any differently. They are happy with the way things are. You know, Jennifer Griffin, I mentioned Jennifer a few minutes ago. She had a rough weekend, right? She had, you know, some of her own colleagues criticizing her. And it's awkward internally when that happens. I had a staffer text me and say, well, what's going to happen? Is Fox going to trust its reporter or keep shitting on its reporter?
Yeah.
And I replied and I said, oh, I think we know. I think we know what's going to happen, right? We know what's going to happen.
Not a close call.
But this doesn't happen in other networks. And it doesn't have to happen at Fox, right? If Lachlan Murdoch or Suzanne Scott were to say, Jennifer Griffin has corroborated key parts of the reporting. So the banners on screen will no longer say fake news because that is misleading and it's undermining our own reporter. If there was strong leadership that stepped in and said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to have it both ways. We're not going to confuse the audience. We're just going to report what we believe to be true. Then the network will be better off. But instead,
so I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to loop around, but I want to push back on one point that people have raised with me, which is that, let's say Shep Smith, we're talking about Shep Smith, was Trump skeptical. Mm-hmm. On Fox, there are voices on Fox that are Trump skeptical, not necessarily in prime time, but they exist. Oh, yeah. In contrast, say, to MSNBC, and I'm a contributor to MSNBC, there are no pro-Trump voices over there. So can you make a case that in some ways Fox is more diverse in its opinions than, for example, some of the other networks?
I think you could make that case. I write toward the end of Hoax that because fact-checking rarely existed on the air at Fox, it fell to the liberal guests, the liberal commentators like Marie Harf and Jessica Tarlov to do the fact-checking that anchors and reporters are supposed to do. But to your point, at least they are there, right? At least Mo Elethi and Juan Williams and Donna Brazile and Marie Harf and Jessica Tarlov are on Fox and are arguing that perspective. I think there's also a case to be made that Fox likes a certain type of Democrat, and you're not going to see a lot of strong Bernie Sanders supporters on the air, right? But there absolutely is an attempt to have liberals on these key shows like Outnumbered and The Five, even if only used as punching bags. There is value to that.
It is striking, though, the degree to which, and when we're talking about Fox, I suppose you could divide it into several different categories, you know, the news side versus the opinion side. And there are really good reporters over there. There's the day side versus prime time. Prime time has not just become Trumpian. How would you even describe that lineup that you have right now? I mean, you know, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham. I mean, this is red meat for on top of the red meat, isn't it?
Yes, it's. To be honest, I struggled with the language for this in the book because I hate the term alternative realities. I use it way too much. I think it's used way too much. But it's true. That's where we are. That's where we are. In fact, we might be beyond it at this point. And a lot of what's broken about our information universe is due to these shows and shows like it, where it's all grievance politics. It's all conservative victimhood all the time. And a lot of it comes back down to whiteness and this sense of whiteness under threat and this sense of a backlash to a browning America. And, you know, I've tried to become more comfortable and confident about calling that what it is. Because that is one of the themes, and we see in last week, Tucker Carlson and critical race theory. That is one of the dominant themes of the broadcasts. I also think it's worth remembering that Channel, I think, is more anti-Democrat than pro-Trump.
Right.
These shows are more anti-Democrat, meaning they'd rather talk about Joe Biden than Donald Trump. That is better. It's better terrain to fight on, right? And I do wonder if we're going to be in one of these scenarios where, a little bit like 2012, Mitt Romney, Fox viewers are going to have such confidence. They're going to have a certain view of Biden, and every time Biden blows up that view, there's a cognitive dissonance, right? Didn't we see that during the Democratic convention when this man who we were told by Fox is limited in his faculties gets up with a passionate, loud speech, and there's this sense of who is that guy? I was sold something else for weeks and weeks and weeks.
One of the things that I worry about, and maybe this is a little bit off topic, is, you know, post-Trump, what is the shape of conservatism in the Republican Party? And if you look at Fox as a leading indicator, you do see this sort of hyper-racial identity nationalism style of politics. I mean, there are different versions of conservatism, and Fox seems to have opted for one of the most virulent strains. So Trumpism doesn't go away when Donald Trump goes away. I mean, there again, you're not seeing free market economics being pushed. You're not seeing American exceptionalism being pushed. The things that 5 minutes ago everybody would have agreed on, it is, as you point out, you know, anti-Democrat, anti-Biden, negative partisanship, which is really the sweet spot. But also, it is that. You know, even more Trumpian on terms of, you know, America first. I mean, Tucker Carlson's pushing a very specific and even almost coherent right-wing ideology that's not going to go away after the election.
Tucker's monologues to me sound like campaign speeches.
Yeah. For literally though?
For 2024. Look, I don't know. Maybe he's more powerful now here on Fox than he would be in a political office, but, I feel like he's thinking 3 years ahead in a way that no other commentator on Fox is, in terms of that's how I read his scripts and that's how I hear his words. To your point, there is a difference between Fox News Republicans and other Republicans.
Right.
And the polls show differences in how supportive those two groups are of Trump. I think a lot of what the post-Trump GOP and post-Trump Fox is, it depends on how much more comes out. Not that scandal number 300 is going to change all support for Trump or post-presidential Trump. But what is it? It's September of 2020, and we just found out that the president allegedly called war veterans losers and suckers. And this happened 2 years ago, or more than a year ago. When was the trip to France? 2018?
Yeah, it was.
It's 2018. It's 2020 now. And that just came out. How much more will there be? And will the same sort of exhaustion that some liberals describe, being exhausted by the news and the scandals and the hatred and the chaos, will there be that kind of exhaustion at some point among the Trump loyalists? They just don't want to hear about what else was happening in the White House. I don't know. I think that's an interesting it's an interesting question that's been on my mind.
This is an interesting question because I do think exhaustion is a function, and I wonder whether, as you get this cascade of embarrassments and scandals and various things, that one of the things you're seeing in the Trump base is they're putting their heads down, not necessarily being exhausted, but narrowing their focus, becoming more committed to the guy and more committed to not hearing counter narratives. You know what I mean? That what you do is you need to hunker down more. You need to focus more. You need to spend more time on these websites, more time watching the hardcore Fox stuff, because that's the way you cope with it. I don't know.
That's very interesting. And then in that scenario, Rupert and Lachlan have even more responsibility and even more power, right? Because if they choose to run on their channel every day, the whataboutism, culture war grievance stuff, the Democrats are coming to ruin your lives and ruin your cities, ruin your suburbs, that is, right? Then that's the state of the GOP.
That is the state of the GOP. Okay,
why is it that Rupert and Lachlan don't talk about this stuff? It drives me crazy that, you know, you go looking for interviews with these men, these power brokers. They barely ever talk about their power or their role. You know, I was able to, through sources, get a sense of Lachlan's indifference, and he's not a religious Fox News viewer. He's not the base. he just wants the business to be well run, and he wants to keep delivering profits. But I wish we as interviewers, as journalists, could talk with them and have them reckon with their power more. It just never happens. Sorry for the tangent. It's one of my first.
So the first line of your book in the prologue. And it is interesting. Everybody that writes a book in the Trump era has to put a prologue on for the last thing that happened, right? To update it. Like you must have written this while the thing was about to go on the press. Because
that's right.
The first sentence is, on March 26, 2020, the people of the United States desperately needed a leader. Instead, they got Donald Trump and Sean Hannity. Tell me what happened that day.
This was the day the American death toll passed 1,000, I believe. This was the day that Elmhurst Hospital was in the national news for overflowing with patients who needed ventilators. This was the day that Trump called into Hannity's show and gossiped for 40 minutes and kept the Chinese president waiting because he wanted to talk to Hannity before talking to the Chinese leader. And it showed how Fox, and especially Hannity, was Trump's safe space, even in the midst of this storm, this pandemic. It was a safe space. It was a waste of his time. It was a waste of the viewers' time. It was a waste of the country's time. So many times when Hannity tries to help Trump, he hurts Trump. And that was certainly, you know, probably most true this year when Fox was downplaying the pandemic. Trump was lulled into this false sense of security, false sense of complacency. And it's certainly, now you don't put all the blame on Fox or anybody. There's a lot of blame to go around for what went wrong in the early stages of this pandemic. But Fox had the biggest platform. Fox had the president's attention. And there's so much nonsense on the air in February and in March that I did have to rewrite the beginning of the book and the end of the book and begin and end with the pandemic as evidence of how this feedback loop, when it's trying to help Trump, hurts Trump, mm-hmm. You know, by leading him astray, by feeding him misinformation. I always think about the day in the end of March when, remember the end of March, there was this narrative about don't let the cure be worse than the disease. Don't let the cure be worse than the problem. This was entirely Fox's fault. We wasted days as a country when the country was still starting to shut down. We were just in the beginning of stages of closing. And Steve Hilton is on Fox saying it's time to reopen. We need to figure out how to reopen. And this is when Trump said, let's fill the pews for Easter. We wasted several days as a country on this narrative about letting the cure be worse than the disease. And it was all because of a Sunday night show on Fox. And look, that's one of 1,000 examples. There's 1,000 other examples about this feedback.
Well, they fired somebody, didn't they? Was it Trish Reagan?
They did. So they did let, fire, what do they do? Yeah. How do they do these complicated contracts? Trish Regan's show vanished all of a sudden because she was on the air talking about this as a scam on the same day that that Hannity was on the air using the word hoax.
Okay, well, that's what I was getting at. So why does she get fired and Hannity doesn't? I mean, I know the answer to this, but I mean, it was a little bit transparent, wasn't it? I mean,
it's what you think. It's that she didn't have power. It's that Hannity has a huge audience. Trish Regan doesn't. There's a way, as one producer said to me, it's hard not to be cynical. We've seen even more inflammatory, dangerous rhetoric from some of the other primetime hosts with no pushback. But she didn't have much power. Well, she didn't have a big audience.
Tell me about this. There was a 5-minute moment when Tucker Carlson was saying, Mr. President, you need to take this seriously. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
And shortly afterwards, you had that 5 minutes where Trump came out and very soberly, you know, took it seriously. And people were going, well, now he's become president. And this is, you know, you know, Donald Trump's FDR moment. I was actually on a show where somebody compared him to FDR. God help us. That didn't last. So to talk about that dynamic with Tucker Carlson, who decided to take it seriously, pushed it. Trump responded. What happened there?
Yeah, March 7th. Yeah. A White House aide asks Tucker to drive to Mar-a-Lago. Tucker's over on the other side of Florida. Please drive to Mar-a-Lago, meet with Trump. The subtext here is talk some sense into him. And Carlson, according to his interviews afterwards, said, I said exactly what I've said on TV, which is this could be really bad. We may have missed the point when we can control it. So Carlson's trying to get the president to take this seriously. Turns out that day at Mar-a-Lago, there were people at the resort that were already sick with COVID. We didn't know because there weren't enough tests. Tucker tried to get a test. Actually, Fox tried to get a test for him later, couldn't get a test. So Trump's government even failed Fox in that situation. But I think, you know, even then, so that was Saturday, March 7th. And this timeline is so depressing to think about in retrospect, because it was 6 months ago this week and there were thousands of people sick and we didn't know it. And it was spreading in ways that, and I mean, I'm sitting here in Midtown Manhattan and I'm thinking about if we had known 2 weeks earlier, right? If we had known 2 weeks earlier, 3 weeks earlier, so many fewer people would have died. So Saturday the 7th, Carlson drives to Mar-a-Lago. But the next Monday the 9th, Trump is still on Twitter comparing this to the flu, saying, you know, last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. Nothing is shut down. So he was in denial even after meeting with Tucker. But you're right that by the end of the week, something did change. By Friday the 13th, ironically, both Fox and Trump's narratives changed. And Trump did that Oval Office address that did not go well, but at least he tried. And by the 13th, according to Lindsey Graham, he says, the 13th is the day when I really saw Trump change. So there was this change at Fox at the same time, by the way, where Suzanne Scott brought the producers of Fox and Friends in and said, no more denialism, no more Jerry Falwell Jr. on the air talking about conspiracy theories, no more Ainsley Earhart saying it's a great time to fly when we are not allowing you all to fly for non-essential reasons. Like there was an attempt at a wake up and a change and maybe a U-turn, but even that U-turn didn't last.
No, it didn't last. And I'm interested in getting your take on this. Sometime within the next week and a half, we're going to cross the threshold of 200,000 American deaths. When we hit 100,000, remember the media made it a big deal. It was a major milestone. The New York Times devoted the entire front page to the names of the victims. How will the media treat the 200,000 milestone? And I think this is going to be very revealing, because have we just kind of gotten used to it? Is it kind of just the background noise, or is it going to be a big moment, do you think?
I just wrote that down for my newsletter tonight, because I hadn't thought about that. And that is a very interesting, very sad, but important question. Will there be those front pages? I suspect that at some news outlets there will be, but I don't know. I suspect that at the Foxes of the world, there won't be as much attention. Have you noticed that on CNN, we still have those graphics with the death toll and the case count, and you don't see that on Foxes often. There has been a partisan divide in the emphasis on coronavirus, right, as a news story. And I think history will look more kindly on the outlets that emphasize it a lot and that focus on the story and that don't give it up and don't let it go. But there's been some of that letting it go. And I know that a lot of blame goes around. It should be spread around widely. But Trump had the biggest platform and Fox had the biggest cable audience. So in the book, I purposely say, hey, this is not my view. Go read the letters that were sent to the FCC from Americans who said the network had failed its audience. These are women and men from Kansas and from South Carolina and from Alabama and all these different states who wrote to the government, even though the FCC does not have regulatory authority over cable, just for the record. They still wrote to the FCC and said, my mom is at risk, you know, because of what she heard on Fox. Quote, Fox is now costing the lives of Americans, a resident in Alabama said. So that feeling, that sense of damage done, is certainly, it's a view that's not just coming from Media Matters. Let's put it that way.
So 8 weeks from today, the election, we probably will not know the results on the election. Does Fox play a, and I don't want this to sound as dumb as it was about to sound. So does Fox play a major role? That's not what I was going to get to. But you know, are there persuadable voters that watch Trump? I mean, what, that watch Fox, or is Fox now become kind of just the niche of fan service for Trump supporters?
Yeah, I think Fox is so big that there are a wide variety of people watching, including some folks who are not Trump diehards. Whether they can be persuaded to support a Democrat, I think is a slightly different question. But I think about it this way. Fox's ratings power is best measured not by looking at Hannity's ratings for one day. We have 3 or 4 million viewers a night, which is still, you know, that's massive. It's bigger than most things on television these days. But it is a sliver of the American electorate. I think the better way to look at Fox's ratings power is look at it over the course of a month. Look at the monthly reach of Fox. And when you do that, you see that Fox is reaching 60 to 70 million people who see the channel at some point in the month. And by the way, that number is similar, a little bit higher for CNN, a little bit lower for MSNBC. But that's the power of these cable channels. It's not in the minute-by-minute ratings. It's in the monthly reach of the channels. And so clearly Fox is reaching an audience that's bigger than just the Trump base. But that's an argument for Democrats to go on Fox, right? It's an argument for Democrats to reach across and appear on these shows. And that's what Mo Elethi says in my book. He's a Democratic Fox contributor who says he used to shun the channel. And now I think it's really important to be on the air to show that he is not the caricature that Hannity makes him out to be. But you know what? He says he refuses to go on shows like Tucker's, right? He has lines that he won't cross even inside Fox.
So you saw the survey recently showing who the public trusts, and obviously only a minority now of Americans trust the information that Donald Trump gives out about the coronavirus. But Trump's credibility rating was still higher than the mainstream media. The last 4 years have seen this relentless attack on the media as the enemy of the people, fake news, etc. Is the non-Foxian media ever going to recover from, and how do they recover from this attack on their credibility, which has obviously had a great deal of effect?
Well, it's a big question. I think what the president's doing against the media is a hate movement. He wants his followers to hate the media. I would never suggest that the solution is a love movement, but that might get us closer to an answer. Meaning, it's a lot harder to hate me when you know who I am. It's a lot harder to hate CNN journalists when you know that they go home to their families and that they have a lot of the same concerns that you and your family has. So I'd like to think that a partial solution, only a partial solution to these problems, is transparency and accessibility, showing our common humanity, showing that none of us are enemies of each other, and showing that we all, we have a lot of the same priorities, right? That the media is not this monolith. You know, I was thinking about this in the context of CNN anchor Breonna Keeler, one of our afternoon anchors, because she said something on the 9 a.m. editorial call at CNN today that stood out to me. Just talking about, you know, what it means when Trump comments on the military, comments on veterans. You know, her husband is an active duty military service member. She describes herself on her Twitter bio or Instagram bio as Antonio's mom, Teddy's stepmom, army wife, you know. So when you start to know her that way, when you know her as an army wife, you know her differently. And you think about her coverage a little bit differently in a way that's better, you know, that in a way that's in context. So that when she's covering this controversy about the Atlantic and covering what the president allegedly said about veterans, she's doing so from a perspective that so many other millions of moms and family members can relate to.
No,
I know this is a full answer to your question, but
I would like to think that
if we can build those bridges, and it's not a love movement, but it's a understanding each other movement. Can we start to counter the hate movement through transparency, through showing, not telling, right? Through providing the primary sources. And when I tell you that the president lied about the weather, here's the video so you can see that it was really sunny and not raining. You know what I mean? If we can provide that kind of evidence, it's not going to sway everyone. But I'd like to think that it starts to help.
I think transparency is a key element here. So let's make a date so when this is all over, when we're all done and everything, to come back on and have a discussion about it. Because I'm torn on this, because I do think that there is a significant problem of media bias, and I think that the media has contributed to the decline of its own credibility. On the other hand, what's happened has been this bad faith attempt to delegitimize all fact-based media. And so in this is an environment where it becomes very difficult to have a nuanced discussion of it. And I think that the media needs to have a good deal more introspection about how we got here. But I certainly also understand that you don't have the introspection when there's so much incoming artillery coming from somebody like Donald Trump, who's launching this blizzard of lies and misinformation. So maybe there will come a time when we can have this sort of back and forth and talk about this, because I'm fascinated by this question, and I think it's going to be a really difficult task to reestablish this when this is all over, because all of the momentum is toward these safe spaces and this, the clickbait universe that does not necessarily prioritize truth. Brian Stelter, thank you so much for joining me. The book, which I strongly recommend, it is a fascinating story. It reads like a novel. It is Hoax, Donald Trump, Fox News, and the Dangerous Distortion of Truth. Brian is the anchor of CNN's Reliable Sources. Talked to more than 250 folks in and around Fox News to get this insider account. You may think you know what goes on there, but this is definitely worth your time. Brian, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
I'm going to add that blurb to the book. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are 55 days to go until the election.